Welcome to SciLax, the podcast where we talk about scientific developments and technological changes in Luxembourg, as usual, powered proudly by Research Luxembourg and recording at the RTL City Studios. And in today's episode, our guest is Dr. Catherine Sedrani, who has recently obtained a PhD at the LCSB, Luxembourg Center for Systems Biomedicine at the University of Luxembourg, and holds a master's degree in biotechnology from RMIT in Melbourne, Australia. Apart from being a researcher, Catherine is also a passionate science communicator, and I hope we will have a long discussion about science communication as well today. Catherine, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so we are kind of going back to one of the episodes we already recorded, in the sense that we will be also looking at gut and gut health. So I want to start with the question that probably you hear a lot, because if people don't know much about your field and your subject, then they have heard something about gut health. In the episode with Alberto Noronha from NEOM and Stefano Pozzimucelli from Lux Innovation, we discussed a lot, and I said that this gut is the new black, you know. So what's going on? Why is it so fashionable?
That's actually a very good question. I mean, we saw that over the last, nearly 20 years, 15 to 20 years, that the field of the gut microbiome, or everything which is related to microbiology in the gut, has risen a lot. And I think this started all with the Human Microbiome Project, where they wanted to characterize the bacteria, or like the microorganisms in our gut, and that they saw like how vast and complex it is. Once we saw that we have pretty much the same amount of bacterial cells as we have human cells, so it means that they play a huge role. And when looking more and more into it, also into disease patients, they saw that the complexity, or like the composition of the gut microbiome, changes, that it is playing a huge role. And of course, as we don't know much about it, or it's like a pretty new field, then yeah, the interest in it rose a lot. And I think also why it is so fashionable is when people say, okay, depending on the diet, we can change it and so on. And for a lot of people, human health is of big interest. Of course, that then became even not just for scientific people interested, but like also people who are not into science, but into health, or yeah, gut health, it became also very interested for them. So it's like not just just like scientific people or people in biology or microbiology, but it's really like interesting for everyone.
It's true. It's something that, you know, we can have some influence over, right? So it's not, okay, I got the right medicine from the doctor, but oh, I ate this or that.
Yeah. And that we can actually think about it, as you also said, with medicine. Like now we know that when we take antibiotics, this can change. So it's not that every time we have a bacterial infection that we immediately should take antibiotics, but we should think about it. Is it really worth it? Like, talking to the doctors, because it can also, let's say, mess up a little bit our microbiome. So it's really important to think about it and think further, because yeah, before it was always that bacteria are often seen as bad. And this has changed since we saw how important they are, so that we are now like, okay, what can we do to actually maintain the gut health or gut microbiome health?
So what do you eat? Do you think about it or not?
From time to time, I have to say that I'm not too crazy about it. I think I always had a pretty healthy diet. Of course, when I talk to children about it, it's not just about eating vegetables and fruits all the time. It's about a balanced diet. So there's nothing wrong with eating a pizza from time to time or a burger, but you have to have that balanced diet, which is very important. So it's all about that.
And it's actually difficult to promote this, because this is one of the kind of messages that we get from everywhere. You should eat a balanced diet, right? So you can't sell it this much. If you say, you know, clickbait type of thing, and you say you should only eat this, then people will be more into it than if you just say, yeah, just, you know, moderation.
Yeah, but I think if you say that you are allowed to eat also sweets and so on, and that you should not cut anything out, that this is actually what is quite important and interesting also for people. Because if they say like, okay, you are only allowed to eat salads as a diet, I mean, at some point it's getting boring. You want something else. And then you are also craving something else, because of course your gut needs different foods as well. So it's really important to see that you should have like a balanced diet. You can eat a little bit of everything, let's say, but it's also very difficult to say, okay, you should exactly eat this and this, and this is the perfect balanced diet, because every individual is different. Every gut microbiome is different. So it's also difficult to say or impossible to say, okay, this is the perfect way to go. So yeah, it's very personalized, let's say.
And that's probably tricky for science communication, because as we both know, you're supposed to say A is B and not, well, maybe sometimes.
And also because the gut microbiome field is still quite new, there's still so many things we don't know. Or I mean, we have so many bacteria in our gut. So how do they actually work together? And how might they be influenced by the food? Some things we do know, but the whole system, how the whole system works, we still don't know. There's still so many parts we still try to figure out, because I mean the field is quite, let's say, relatively new, or like where the interest came is relatively new. So there's still so many things we don't know. So it's really difficult to then say, okay, this is like that, and if you do this, it will be fine. It might not be fine for a different person. So yeah, it's a bit complicated.
So let's move to something we do know. So it's easier on you as well. I wanted you to tell us a little bit about humix, and what is that, and what you've done, and where can we find, can we actually see it? No, it's closed behind doors, right? Only for you scientists.
Yeah, well, the humix, so to start with what it is. So humix is the short term for human microbial crosstalk model. And this is a model which was invented by Professor Paul Wilmer's group back in 2016. It was published first. So humix is gut on a chip model. So with the interest in gut microbiome, also the interest in gut on a chips increased as well. So humix is a way to mimic our human gut. It is made out of three different cell chambers. The top chamber includes the bacterial cells. In the middle chamber, we have the epithelial cells. Epithelial cells are kind of like the gut wall. So we need that wall, same as in our gut, which is protecting whatever is inside our gut with what is around. So for example, the bacteria should not invade or go into our blood. So this is like the wall which puts the barrier between the gut lumen and everything which is inside. And then on the bottom, when I started, we had immune cells in it, but I was interested in how the gut microbiome interacts with the nervous system. And this was something when I started my PhD end of 2018, that has not been done yet, that you have a gut model which has gut bacteria as well as the enteric nervous system. So I decided that I wanted to try and establish the enteric nervous system in the bottom chamber, so that we have a model where we can see how the gut bacteria interact with the enteric nervous system. But as this has never been done, that was a quite long process. But now we have a model where we have the enteric nervous system inside, and that we can look at that communication between gut bacteria and the enteric nervous system.
But why is it so problematic? You just put those cells there and you look what happens.
Yeah. Well, putting those cells there is already quite difficult and a long process, because first of all, like to get the enteric nervous system we were using, we differentiate them from stem cells, and that process takes already 5 to 6 weeks. So after 5 to 6 weeks, they are ready to use. And then you have to put them in a different model or environment, let's say, because usually we have them in plates, in cell culture, which is all established and so on. But the humix environment is different, because there are different cell types also inside, and also how it works. There's, for example, all the time media flow. Media is like, let's say, where the nutrients for the cells come. So there's all the time a little flow in there, which is usually not in cell culture. So all those different factors play a role. Can then the cells survive in there? Will they attach to the surface or not? So it's a long process. And also, how will they react when they are close to other cell types? Because of course, in the body, in the human body, it does all work. But how does it work outside of the body? How can we make it possible? Because of course, the body is much more complex, but how can we do it in a simple way, but that it's still working? So that took quite a long time to make it work. But in the end, it did. So yeah, the model works now.
Okay, and it's there. But as I asked before and you did not answer, is it actually something interesting to see for the general public or not? Because, you know, would we understand seeing it?
To see it, let's say if you're interested in gut models, it's interesting to see how it is made up, because The group of Professor Wilmers is the only one so far in the world who has it at the moment. So if you're interested in that model and you want to see it, it's only there where you can see it. You can't see how the different cell types are interacting with each other. And also when the experiment is running, it's all closed. So also for us, it's just waiting that you can finally open, get the cells and then do all the analyses afterwards and then see the data. But the process itself, of course, when you're into it, then it's like, okay, let's see how it goes. But if you're not into it, it's a spiral shape, which you see where actually the cells are growing. And then it's in a plastic, or now the newer version is in a metallic clamp. And then it's connected to media, to a pump and so on. And that's it.
Okay. And then how do you manage to see actually what's going on? Is there some microscopy or how do you see inside?
During the process, you can't.
Okay.
You just have to trust it. That's also why it takes quite a long time to see if it did work or not. For example, to now put the enteric neurons inside, you don't see during the experiment, did it work or not? So at the beginning, if you wanted to see if the neurons actually attached and grew in the device, we had to wait. For example, at the beginning, I was only running it for 4-7 days. And then I had to figure out, okay, how long can I run them? In the end, we figured out we have to run them for 14 days. So if I started one for 14 days and there might have been an issue and the cells died right away, I wouldn't see it. I would only see it after 14 days. So
there's an exercise in patience.
There's a lot of patience involved and so on. In theory, once we knew like how it works, it usually does work. In general, once you started after 14 days, it was fine. But to get to that point, it was quite a long process. During the process, you don't see much. You just see the media going from one side to another. It might be actually interesting to see that model is actually mimicking the gut, because I don't know what people outside the field, what they think how a gut on a chip looks like.
Probably a tube.
Yeah, probably, but it's not. So.
Yeah, absolutely. You would have to say, that's, by the way, the thing. All right. Yeah. I remember I was also asking you when we were preparing that one of the videos I saw, you were just obviously putting some, whatever it was, substance into some, you know, containers. And I was thinking like, why is it that when we see scientific videos, it's normally something like that. You're obviously wearing some lab coat and then you're supposed to do that. I don't think on the video there was the Humix shown. At least I did not notice.
No, I think the video you were talking about was also from RTL, where the Women in Science.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. No, that was where I did analysis of the samples afterwards. So it was not the actual Humix device. It is difficult to show. The thing is, people always have a specific way how they think about scientists or like what they do. But of course, we are not pipetting every day and not all the time just looking at tubes and so on. For example, I was working with Humix. But yeah, if we would show that, I don't know how people react. What I did sometimes was, for example, doing lab tours that when people came to visit. And there we have, for example, also a poster who is really showing, okay, the different layers in Humix, what they actually look like in the gut layers and so on, because it is still difficult to put your head around what is happening and what should it actually mimic. Then it's easier if you have the Humix device and you have maybe an image to show like people who are not from the field what's going on.
Of course, although I still have to say that your field is kind of okay for science communication.
Yeah.
I recently talked to someone who is a theoretical physicist, and I think that is really tricky to do psychom in.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Exactly. So here it's also, you know, the relevance for our body, for our health, that you can always try to filter it through and then it becomes kind of more understandable in some way.
Yeah, and people can relate to it. That's something which is, I guess, let's say, easy in our field for science communication, because I mean, why did we actually put the effort in putting enteric neurons in the Humix device? This is because the idea actually came as the LCSB is very interested in Parkinson's disease. And the group from Professor Wilmers, where I did my PhD, is very interested in everything microbiome. So microbiology, we're like, yeah, okay, there is a hypothesis, because we still don't know how and where Parkinson's, the disease, starts. We know that it's mainly happening in the main symptoms are like happening in the brain, and people were always focusing on the brain. But it was seen that a specific neuronal protein, which is in the brain, has also been found in the gut in the enteric nervous system. And then it was like, maybe it can actually start in the gut. But we don't know because we never looked at how the gut microbiome interacts with the enteric nervous system. Now we do, but it was something which people were not too much interested in. And the field is still very new and it is really evolving at the moment. And then when people know, maybe I know someone who has Parkinson's disease and this is why you do that, because there's still so much unknown. And then they can relate much more to the field. And then it's easier to talk to them and explain what you are doing and why we are doing it.
Of course, but it's also trickier to do science as such, I think, because nowadays the scientists are required to be really interdisciplinary. Because as you're saying, like in the past, you know, you had your field, you did the research within that and it's okay. And now suddenly you actually have to cooperate way more and better, be a specialist in all of it.
Yeah, because also when I was talking to friends, for example, what I'm doing, they were like, okay, but are you still doing pure microbiology? Because my background is mostly microbiology. And I was like, no, now I'm working with neurons, which I have never done before. I'm working with a gut on a chip, which is also, you have to do a little bit of engineering, let's say, because if something doesn't work, how can you change it and so on? So you try to figure that out as well. And it's just like a lot which comes together, which is very exciting. But of course, then you're going out of your field and out of your comfort zone. But it's nice to have some more challenges and put also those different fields together and also interact with people from different fields. Because again, for example, everything neurons, I had no idea about stem cells. I didn't know what to do with them. So I had to learn that. And then we collaborated with someone else from LCSB. And then I got to interact with other scientists and so on, which was a great experience.
And before you tell me a little bit more, because I want to know, of course, what happens next. And I know that you left that after PhD, there's someone taking over, let's say, which is not so easy. But before you tell me that, I think it's the moment to ask you to ask the pub quiz question. So a little bit, you know, again, relating to people's knowledge and what they know, what they don't know. So as usual, listeners, remember the answer is only at the end. So now we just only ask the question, then we will repeat the question and give you the answer. So listen until the end.
Sometimes when we talk about gut microbiome, we hear about microbes, but also bacteria. Is there a difference between microbes and bacteria? Is it the same? What do you think?
So that answer, as usual, at the end of the podcast, don't Google. I know we can find answers everywhere right now, but it's going to be a proven answer because it's coming from an expert and you don't know. Don't ask ChatGPT as well. I should mention that I need to change right now because it's all about that nowadays. Okay, good. So coming back, I completely don't understand one point. So you put these together in the model. And what are you looking for? Like what kind of interactions? What do you want to see? What can you understand afterwards? I know that this is not what you did because you actually just developed the model. It's a lot of work as far as I understand. But of course, it's now to the others who have it to see what kind of interactions we can figure out from it.
Or what I can actually also say, because when I started the project, we had an idea what I wanted to do once it works. Unfortunately, I never came that far. But the idea and why we actually made it was, again, it was based on Parkinson's disease. Also at the LCSB, we have a lot of samples from Parkinson's disease. So what we wanted to see is when we have, for example, the gut microbiome from a Parkinson's patient, but then we take the epithelial and the neuronal cells from a healthy patient, do we see changes in the enteric nervous system? Because that was what the hypothesis about the start of Parkinson's disease is. Might it start in the gut if there is a change in the gut microbiome? So if we would take now the gut microbiome from a diseased patient, would we see those changes? Or also the other way around, what if we have a healthy gut microbiome from a healthy individual and we have the enteric nervous system from a diseased patient? Will it go back? Like, will we see changes in the enteric nervous system or not? So that was like really the main questions. We want to see if we change the gut microbiome, will we see changes in the enteric nervous system as well? And then you can go, of course, also to other diseases, because it has also been seen that also other neurological diseases are influenced probably by the gut microbiome, and to see if something happens there also in the enteric nervous system. Because if we go now a step further, there is like that gut-brain axis where they see that a lot happens there. So this is the first step of the gut-brain axis, what happens between the bacteria in our gut and the enteric nervous system, to then maybe understand later on what might happen between the enteric nervous system and the brain.
I'm happy to hear about this stage of development because, you know, I always found it interesting that I go to the doctor and he or she just looks at part of my body and not the whole system.
Yeah. When I started my studies, I was always very fascinated by the gut microbiome. And at that point, I was also unaware how far it can actually go, because you have interactions between gut microbiome and an enteric nervous system. The enteric nervous system is, of course, linked to the other nervous system, which goes up to the brain. And that this can actually, depending on what bacteria you have in your gut, can actually influence your brain, which is crazy when you think about that. So that's very interesting. And we still don't know everything, or like there's still so much to discover, let's say.
I'm sure I will be inviting someone else from the lab to tell us hopefully soon about some brilliant discovery.
That would be amazing.
Yes, I would be really happy to hear that. But before that happens, what is your opinion about posters at conferences when you present? I saw your picture somewhere with a poster. I think it was in Japan. You were very, very happy about it. And then I looked at the poster, and I've been to quite a lot of conferences and I've seen a lot of posters. And as a science communicator, I do have certain opinion about them. So tell me, actually, what is the role of a poster at such conferences? It's kind of a spark to start a discussion about your research, I guess.
Exactly, because so a conference, let's say the main big two parts where you can promote your science is either you give a talk or a poster. Of course, the talks are always very limited and so on. So especially young scientists are mostly getting the opportunity to show a poster, like make a poster, stand next to it, and hope that people show interest in it.
So you should be putting glitter on it or something.
I mean, it's very, let's say, as an individual, if you get attracted to a poster or not, because what is a good poster or not? Like, for example, I can imagine if you would put glitter on it, there will be probably a few people who are like, why did you put glitter on it? This is pretty cool. But others are like, she's not serious enough. You know, like she's not taking science serious enough. So they would not come to you to talk to you. So it's really difficult to find a way, you know, like to attract people to come and talk to you. But it is a way to promote your science and talk about people, about your science.
Does it mean you have to prepare the illustrations separately, or they are often taken from your publications already?
It all depends. I mean, it also depends. We have people working in our group who are amazing with making figures and graphs and so on. So they might also do their own illustrations. I am not that artistic. So I had, for example, a postdoc in our group who made like a nice illustration of how I imagined neurohumics. So I used that, for example, to kind of attract the attention of people. And then, of course, you show some data of your own project. But it really depends. Some people also put pretty much only text on it. So it's very, also you have the time to do it, how you like to do it, how you, if you see the poster as like, this is pleasing to your eye or not. So it's difficult to say, okay, this is a good poster, this is not a good poster. And yeah, if you can attract people with it or not.
As a layperson, for me, they are mainly scary, but that's just me. It's probably too many, you know, footnotes and stuff going on there. And then I look at the words and I've never seen them before. And I'm like, okay, picture. Oh, but this is a graph that I don't understand. Okay, yeah, I'll just go somewhere else. But that's just me. Obviously, you're doing it for people who are specialists in the field, not for me.
Yeah, but it depends. Because, I mean, sometimes, again, as often our projects are very interdisciplinary. The conferences you might go might not like that your project fits completely into that field. So also the other projects might be also not completely your field. And for me, for example, I always try to put not too much on a poster, because I get always scared when there's too much text and too many data. And I'm like, oh, where should I start? And then maybe the person is currently not there, so they can't explain. And then I go to the next one. So I try to keep it rather, let's say, simple and pleasing to the eye, in my opinion. I think when you have the possibility to attract people, then it's also easier when you can actually talk to them. And that's, I think, the most important part, because when you don't talk to them, it's really they pass by and nothing much happens. But if you talk, that's the important and exciting part where you then can actually talk about the science. They might have questions where you haven't thought about it and so on. So, yeah.
Yeah, that is important part of doing science, talking to each other as well. For sure. Okay, you said artistic part. So I have to ask about one of the science communication projects you participated in. So the series of comics.
Ah, yeah.
Right, you're looking at me, where is she going? Yes, the comics. I already discussed it with some of my guests because, of course, there are quite a lot of different ones that have been done and some of my guests have participated as well. So how was this experience and what was the comic about that you helped or chipped in?
Yeah, so I was part of the comic Luxploration Volume 1, which was made during 2020. And we were always, I think, three to four people on one comic. The challenge was actually that the comic had to be only 2 pages. So it's like, how do you get like a message across in 2 pages? And our group, we decided to actually take the gut microbiome as our topic. The audience should be rather teenagers, let's say. So we also talked about diet. And the comic message was that you have to have a balanced diet, because the main comic was that someone from another planet came to Belval as an exchange semester. And she enjoyed pizza that much that she was only eating pizza all the time. And then her stomach ached all the time and she was like, oh no, what's going on? And then her friend, who was made kind of out of water, went into her belly to check what's going on. And he saw that there was a huge mess and there were like bad bacteria in there hurting her and her gut and everything. And that when he came out, he understood that, okay, he was talking to the good bacteria and they were like, yeah, we are starving here because only the bad bacteria are eating all the time the pizza. We need something else. And that's why so many of us are already gone. So it was really about showing, okay, it's not good to only eat one food only. It's really about keeping your gut microbiome balanced so that you are healthy, that you are in a good shape. And that's also why it's important then to have like a balanced diet.
Okay. Must have been a difficult process to kind of put it on 2 pages, right?
It was, because of course you can't put too much text in there, but every group was working with a comic artist from Luxembourg, which was actually pretty cool because, again, I'm not very artistic. So it was nice. Someone else was doing the drawings, of course. And that was very interesting also to see the evolvement over time from the idea to, okay, how can we maybe put it into 2 pages, the different pens, because that was done also like we had to learn about, yeah, how are comics actually made, because you're also not putting 50 panels on one page and so on. So it was very interesting. But in the end, we made it. And yeah, I was very happy to be part of this.
Did the artist understand what you meant? Because I think this is also crossing to another world.
So we also had, of course, meetings with him, so that sometimes when he draws something which was not, let's say, making sense in a scientific way, that we could also say, maybe make it different. And also, like, the first step was to really explain what our message was to the artist so that he also understood what was going on. But that was really an amazing project. I really enjoyed it a lot.
And you can still find those for sure online. You can download them online. And sometimes I notice also during some conferences, maybe more kind of, I know, science festivals, whatever, you can also find. But most probably the latest.
The latest, probably, yes. Because the older ones, I don't know if they are still too many around, that I'm not sure. But you can definitely find them on online. They are still, I think, yeah, all the volumes are online, so they can be found online.
And for sure, you can also participate in some of the workshops sometimes where you are as well. And I just wanted to ask you, because as I said, you're passionate about science communication. What's so cool about it? Why do you like it? It's tricky. People don't get what you're saying. You have to water down your message. You can't be precise.
Yeah, but true. That's like being precise. And so, I mean, we are still precise, but in an, let's say, easy way. So most of the science communication I did was more related to interacting with a younger audience, not that much with older people, but more like with the younger audience. And also doing like little workshops and so on. And what I always enjoyed most is when you see that excitement in their eyes, when you saw, okay, I got the message across and they are enjoying. And also when they start questioning and starting to ask more questions, because sometimes you have like a 7 or 8 year old and they are asking questions. You're like, I didn't think of that. So it can be also very rewarding, let's say, to talk to other people and especially younger people, because they see the things also differently. And yeah, for me, science, I have been fascinated by science since a very young age. And just to give something back and also show them that this is actually a way they might go into if they really want to do that. And if they are passionate about it, it's something just I really enjoy. And I mean, science is everywhere. Yeah, it's so fascinating. And in whatever field you go, if it's like math, physics, biology, chemistry, it's just like...
History as yeah. well. Don't forget about humanities.
More into life sciences, sorry, history and all of those, of course, as well. But it is amazing. I mean, but of course, it's the science communication... not the problem, but like to get the message actually across, it's tricky. So if you are able to do that and invest some time into realizing how you should talk to non-scientific audiences, it can be very rewarding. So I really enjoy that. I know it's not for everyone, but I really enjoy it because I'm passionate about science. So just, yeah, give that back. It's kind of cool.
I know what you mean. For me, the problem is normally that there's just too much to know and not enough time. And especially when I'm preparing for the interviews and, you know, I just kind of get into all those worlds and then I discover some scientific journal I had no clue about. That is so interesting. That kind of gets you closer to, I don't know what, but somehow you solve at least one mystery that you didn't know about before.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it's very important to keep it also understandable for other people because, again, for the younger audience, if they understand what you're saying, that's then also where they start questioning. Because if they don't understand anything what you're talking about, yeah, then what questions should they ask? And I think science and especially research, it's all about, yeah, having questions. And this is very fascinating. And I think it's exactly what you say, like when you have that passion and then you get into maybe a complete different topic than you have any knowledge about, and then you start reading, you understand, you ask more questions, you go further and further, and then you yeah, it's like a black hole, you can't get out of there, you just go further, and at some point you're not at the topic where you actually started, but it's still so interesting and it's an amazing world. So
yes, totally. But then also, as you said, there's always this problem of the message. So if you are communicating, you need to think, okay, what do you want people to take away from the moment, right? So for example, I know that you were there, was it Researchers Days or Science Festival?
Yeah, last in the Researchers Day.
Yeah, exactly. And it was, again, some kind of a gut microbiome discussion, right? So what is the message? Is the message as simple as don't eat pizza, as in the comic? Or is it, oh, you're trying to go deeper? What is the level where you stop?
Well, it always depends what your or who your audience is. I mean, how far you can go. For example, for the Researchers Days, we knew it were high school students, or we should focus mostly on high school students. The second day, they were also families, but let's say we try to keep it a little bit higher. So we had, for example, also microscopy that they could see what's, for example, in the yogurt, that we have bacteria in the yogurt. And then also we had like a little workshop where they could extract, let's say, DNA from their saliva. So they spit into a cup and then in the end, you could actually see the DNA floating in there, because there we went further than just like talking about bacteria or microorganisms. We went also to DNA, what's inside and so on. So you can go very far. But for this workshop, it was not as much about the diet. It was really microbes and bacteria. They are everywhere. Often in people's head, they are still those bad bacteria, to also show them, no, they are not all bad. They do have an effect on us, a beneficial effect, and that without them, we wouldn't be able to survive. And just, yeah, to show them that they are everywhere, not just in and on our body, but also in an environment and so on, and in our food and things like that. So it went really a little bit further, let's say. So yeah, that's again, like when you do a workshop, how far will you go? And who is your audience and so on. So yeah, there's a lot of possibilities.
Always, always. By the way, I'll be there this year at the Science Festival. So I also go, you'll see how far I went with the project. I can't wait.
I'm excited to see that.
Yeah, it's going to be about statistics and table tennis. That's the plan so far. So yes, I'm not revealing anything more, but I'm definitely going to tell you listeners soon what we are planning to do. And I hope it's going to be with a bang.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yes, exactly. I think we are kind of really on the same page here for sure. I guess listeners can hear the excitement in our voices. Okay, before we solve the pop quiz question, because I think we're slowly coming to an end, and I was thinking, like you mentioned, microbes and bacteria, so it's the moment to tell our listeners. But before we do that, I realized when we were talking about your lab work, I didn't ask you one question that is really, really interesting to me, is the question, how does a normal day of a scientist look like in your case? Because, you know, we were already discussed, you know, when you have a film, you have to show something and it's always tricky. So is it really like you sit in front of a computer with the data, you analyze that? That's as simple as that? Or what is it? Or is it, you also mentioned 14 days you have to wait. So you just go on, you know, package holidays somewhere and then you come back when it's done.
So in research, there's always something to do. There's always, I mean, if...
Drinking coffee, for example, with your
very
peers,
important.
Very important, I know.
Don't forget the coffee. No, but a normal day, it's difficult to say because every day looks a little bit different. But let's say for me, in general, when I came into a lab, usually I started early in the morning. First, of course, you check your email to see what's going on. And then I usually started right away in the lab doing all my lab work. So looking after the cells, because as I said, the neurons, they had to grow for 6 weeks. So that's something you don't stop. So you have to do that kind of either look after them every single day or maybe every second day. But it's something which is all the time on your schedule. Same for the epithelial cells. So that barrier, that wall where we were talking about, they also need to stay in culture, not as long as the neurons, but still. And then before the experiments, of course, getting everything done, for example, for humix, there's a lot of sterilization processes there because it should be very, very clean or otherwise you have contaminations and your experiment is not worth anything. So all of those things have to be done. So usually then I did my lab work in the morning, maybe until early afternoon. And then afterwards, I was then sitting on the computer and doing everything which was still needed to be done on the computer, because there's also like things like ordering all your lab work. So looking, doing the inventory, what is needed, and then also doing all the planning, because there's a lot of planning involved, things like that. So it really depended. Sometimes you were also going to a conference, so you had to...
So ask someone else to feed the cells.
Yeah. That's always like... seeing what can be done and what can't be done, or when can you actually go on vacation, because then you are gone for like maybe a week.
You can't go with them.
Unfortunately, no. But that was all like, yeah, the planning is very important. And again, always making sure that nothing is missing, which was a little bit more tricky during the COVID times, because of course, supply chains were sometimes, overwhelmed. All of those things, a lot of organizing, planning, but it's also changing. Again, like when you went to a conference, then you had a poster to prepare, or maybe a talk, or maybe you had a workshop to do, or, you know, like you did also courses, because during the PhD, you also have to take courses. So it's really, your days are easily filled up.
I understand.
And when you have a little bit of time, then of course, there's so much literature you can look at and really keep up to date with that. So there's just like, you are never bored.
And you need space also to kind of, you know, get the thought process going, to make some links and all that, that kind of science that is for some people just sitting idly somewhere. But, you know, you need to have that space.
Yeah, because that's also something I did a lot with my colleagues, talking about what's going on and so on, because I'm also more productive when I actually can talk to someone about what I'm doing and then see what they think, so that you might come also to other conclusions or other ideas, or you see like, okay, maybe I can change my experiment a little bit and things like that. So you have things you have to do every day in the lab, but also there's always like changes. No day is the same as the other day, so it always changes.
Of course, I have to reveal now why I'm asking this question. I haven't revealed it yet, and I do ask it once in a while to my guests. There is a story when I was a child. My father was working at the university. He was a nuclear physicist, actually. And of course, you know, the usual teacher question. So what does your father do? Do you know what I said? Well, he drinks tea. Because basically, whenever I visited him, you know, it was just this office thing and he had a break. So he would have tea with me. So that's, for me, that's what he does for a living. He drinks tea. That's why I'm also interested and I like discussing it, because exactly, it might seem to some people that it's, you know, that not that visibly productive, let's say, because it's not really, you know, making a hole in the ground or whatever. It's very much this kind of ecosystem discussions and as I said, very much changing, which is good.
It's good. It's varied. No, that's true. No, there's a lot of different aspects which come into play when it comes to being in research, working in the lab, and also things like finding fundings. Okay, sometimes as a PhD student, you might not be as involved as like the more senior researchers, but still you sometimes you have to find also funding. And, you know, like it's a lot.
I would say more often than sometimes.
Yeah. But again, like as a PhD student, I was a little bit more lucky to not like have to write grants all the time. But it's just something you have to think about, or you know, okay, I only have that much money, so I need to do those experiments. Is it enough? Is it not? What can I change? And things like that. So it's not just like going into the lab, doing your lab work, going home, and it's easy done. No, it's there's a lot of things which are involved in research and in your daily life.
And it's also looking at microbes and bacteria in your case. I think it's the moment to ask the question once again, and then if you can tell us the answer.
Is there a difference between microbes and bacteria? Is it the same? What do you think? Let's say every bacteria is a microbe, but not every microbe is a bacteria. So microbes is kind of like the group of microorganisms, which not only include bacteria, but also, for example, viruses and fungi. But yeah, so every bacteria is a microbe, but not every microbe is a bacteria.
Okay, clear. I think now everyone will remember that. Everyone will. But and somehow we don't have a feeling that the microbes are bad, right? They don't have the bad press. The bacteria do.
Yeah. Because we are also not talking too much about fungi. For example, when I was now talking about the gut microbiome, in my personal case, I always focus on the bacteria because that was also my project was based on the bacteria. But we also have viruses in our gut. We have fungi in our gut and so on. So it's not just the bacteria. So it always depends. Like when you talk about, the microbes in our gut, you talk about all of them, all the microorganisms. But if you just focus on the bacteria, it's really just the bacteria.
Okay. And I assume there are people also looking at the fungi in the gut.
They are. Yeah. And also when I was at the conference, there were also a group of people who were looking at all the viruses in the gut, which is also not too much done. But but I think the most focus is still on the bacteria, but they see that all the other microbes are playing a part as well.
So we've learned a lot. Once again, if you want to know more, as usual, listen to other podcasts where we had LCSB scientists, because we did discuss a little bit already some research done in the Parkinson's disease field was with Ibrahim Boussard. And then also we discussed, as I mentioned, a little bit with Alberto Noronha, who was at certain moment based at LCSB. So do check it out. And of course, all the other episodes. And thank you so much, Catherine, for coming today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And of course, I have to say the usual thing. So please don't forget to subscribe, to follow us, to check what we are writing on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, and anywhere else we are present. Suggest the guests, contact us and tell us what you think about the podcast. This was Silex. And my name is Hanna Siemaszko.